Welcome to the Dairy Farmers of Canada's research podcast series, Paths to On-Farm Excellence, where we discuss priority topics for Canadian dairy farmers. My name's Stephen Roach. I'm an epidemiologist with a passion for dairy cattle health and welfare. I did my master's and PhD trying to understand how farmers, their staff, and their advisors can work together as a team to improve. And I'm part of a team that's working with the Dairy Farmers of Canada to help showcase the latest in dairy research for Canadian dairy farmers, advisors, and their supply chain. You'll find this channel features a number of different series, from animal care to biosecurity to research summaries and beyond. This podcast series features conversations with farmers, veterinarians, nutritionists, hoof trimmers, and other farm advisors, researchers, and many other industry stakeholders. Our goal is really to provide farmers and their advisors with useful information that can be applied back home on the farm. If you like the content here, don't forget to subscribe to our feed and tell your friends. In this episode, we're joined by Ben Caddy and Ellen DeYoung, two researchers that are going to talk to us a little bit about udder health treatment decisions and antimicrobial resistance. The dairy industry recognizes the critical challenge of antimicrobial resistance and is working to promote antimicrobial stewardship to limit the development of antimicrobial resistant bacteria. Udder health is an important area to target for reduction of antimicrobial use, as mastitis treatments and dry cow therapy are responsible for the majority of antimicrobials used on dairy farms today. Animal and human health are an interconnected web. Continue listening on here to learn more about how antimicrobial treatment decisions on a dairy farm may impact human health. So, let's jump in. All right. Well, Ben, Ellen, it's a pleasure to have the chance to sit down and chat with you on a topic that, globally, we've been talking about for some time. A tremendous amount of research going on, and I'm really excited to say and proud to say that Canada has been a big leader in some of this work in the context of agriculture, and in particular, the lab that you've been working in with Dr. Herman Barkema, some really significant strides being made on the front of antimicrobial or antibiotic resistance, and we'll talk about what that means and how to unpack that in a moment. But for now, thanks for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Steve.
Hi.
So let's start off with a little bit of introductions. Ben, maybe you can kick us off. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into this topic in particular and find yourself in the University of Calgary?
Yeah, so I'm in my second year of my PhD with Herman Barkema and his lab group. Originally, I grew up in Ontario on a dairy farm. It's a bit of a long journey how I made it from a dairy farm to working on antimicrobial resistance and genomics of that. But after I did my undergrad, I worked at Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada on biofertilizers and doing the farm work there. And then I went to the University of Calgary for my master's degree working on digital dermatitis, where I got an interest in antimicrobial resistance through that. And so jumping into Herman Barkema's lab, working on AMR in dairy cattle pathogens was kind of a natural step for me.
Yeah, very cool. It's always amazing how you end up in some of these places and the winding journey you take, right?
Absolutely.
Ellen, same question for you. How'd you get in here into the position you're in today? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so maybe a little bit of background as well, that I'm from the Netherlands originally, near Rotterdam. That's where I grew up, not on a farm. But my dad's side of the family is coming from a long lineage of farmers. So I did animal sciences for my bachelor and master, and that's how I made my way to Canada, working with Karen Orschel also on digital dermatitis for my master's, and then with Herman for my PhD. Yeah, I'm now in my fifth year. Time's flying. I really was really open on working with antibiotic use and resistance because I like topics that are sort of on that interplay between animal health and human health. And this is, of course, a topic that connects both of those worlds.
No kidding. It certainly does. And you know, all three of us have sort of mentioned a couple of different terms there that I think is worth, you know, us starting with just to bring everyone who's listening on the same level. So Ben, you've mentioned AMR. I've mentioned antimicrobial resistance. Sometimes we use resistance. Sometimes we talk about antibiotics specifically. Sometimes we throw around prudent use and stewardship. There's a lot of terms, especially in this topic. So let's start with a couple of simple questions. What is antimicrobial resistance and what is antimicrobial stewardship?
I guess we can kind of broadly define it as I guess, a capacity of bacteria to be unaffected by any drugs that kind of target them, to stop them from growing or to kill them in general, right? So for example, penicillin, some bacteria can be completely resistant to penicillin, a very common antibiotic. Why it's kind of important to note that antimicrobial resistance has always existed. A lot of antibiotics, antimicrobials are produced by naturally occurring fungi, and it's kind of a defense mechanism for bacteria to grow alongside these fungi that produce antimicrobials. What's kind of alarming about antimicrobial resistance right now is just how common it is now. And Ellen is our expert on the antimicrobial stewardship, so she can talk about that.
So because it's so common, it has become sort of a health hazard. And we're all aware of how important it is for our human doctors to not prescribe antibiotics when it's not needed, but that holds the same for our veterinarians, of course, and for dairy farmers when making those treatment decisions. So when we talk about stewardship, we really mean responsible use of antibiotics, being very cautious and making conscious decisions about when you administer antibiotics and when you don't. But on a broader level, stewardship also means monitoring how resistance patterns change over time, where do we see resistance and what influences that, and also developing tools to help farmers, veterinarians, and other people who work with antibiotics and antibiotic administration to be more responsible and aid them in that diagnostics.
Okay, I think that's really helpful. It breaks it down a little bit. So why is this important from a dairy industry perspective? Isn't this, you know, given the volume or the amount of drugs used in other livestock species or in humans, isn't this just as, if not more important for some of them? And aren't we as the dairy industry some of the lower users of antibiotics?
I can comment on that. Yeah, no, we're definitely, especially compared to beef industry or more intensive farming such as pig farming, we're not using a whole lot. We hardly ever do complete herd anaphylaxis treatments, but it doesn't mean that the treatments that we're doing are all justified. And it doesn't mean that there's still a push from consumers, from the public, to be responsible and to show that we care and we care about this problem as a whole. So we have to do our part. And I think that's really important why we talk about it in this podcast.
Yeah, I think it's also really important to note that over 1 million people are dying directly due to antimicrobial resistant infections every year globally. So anybody that's responsible for any kind of antibiotic usage should be involved in the fight against AMR.
Something that is often overlooked is when we think about antibiotic use on dairy farms, that we think of it's the risk of developing resistance in those cows. But it's also for the farm workers who work directly with the cattle and who are in daily contact with cattle and with manure to potentially attract those resistant bacteria as well. So it's not just for your animals, or if you don't see it as a problem for your animals on your farm, it can still be harmful to you.
Those are great comments. I mean, you're right. At the end of the day, we all have a role to play, whether we are significant users or minor users, if that's a fair term to use. I mean, we're using these drugs. We have a responsibility to do, you know, use them prudently and then also consider the ramifications. So Ben, I think this is probably a better question to at least start off with you. Talk to us about how resistance actually moves from bacteria to bacteria. How does this actually develop and extend out to actually having impact on those million lives you talked about? And maybe just a quick anecdote too, is that it's shocking to me the number of people I know personally that have started to comment and say, I've experienced a, you know, antibiotic resistance, or had a discussion with my practitioner, you know, as a and my human health doctor talking about issues around that. So it seems to be more prevalent, and the data seems to bear that out as well. So talk to us about how this actually happens at the bacteria level.
Right, exactly. And you raise a good point in how we are worried about the spread of AMR from bacteria to bacteria, right? So we're not so much worried about some bacteria are naturally resistant to a certain antimicrobial, which can happen because antibiotics selectively target some aspect of bacterial cells. Some bacteria just lack that target. What we're worried about is it spreading from bacteria to bacteria? And we call that horizontal transmission. And that happens through the transfer of DNA from one bacteria to another. So this can happen directly. So about some bacteria come into contact, they have some sort of genetic mechanism that allows the DNA to transfer between the two different types of bacteria. What can also happen is a bacterial cell dies, some of the DNA escapes the cell, goes into the environment, another bacteria can pick up that DNA. And then the final way that antibiotic resistance can spread is through viruses, and viruses that specifically infect bacteria. We call them bacteriophages. They can pick up DNA from a bacteria and then spread it to another bacteria. What's probably the most common form of it happening, at least on dairy farms, and the type of pathogens that are let's say, cause mastitis like E. coli, Staphylococcus aureus, is more of that environmental DNA or direct bacteria to bacteria kind of a mechanism, which is also kind of scary because if it comes into contact with us, those antimicrobial resistant bacteria on our skin through consumption of products or fecal oral route or something like that, it's been shown many times that DNA transfer or antimicrobial resistance gene transfer from one bacteria to another can happen on the farm worker surface, right? So a very scary mechanism there.
No kidding. Is it fair to say this can happen quickly? Like, can resistance develop rather quickly, Ben? Or is that something that actually takes time? And I don't know what that time frame is, but help us, our listeners, understand what time course does this happen?
Well, if you think about it this way, E. coli replicates every 20 minutes. So doubles its copies every 20 minutes. And so when you have that massive expansion, you have a massive expansion, increased rate of mutation, increased rate of just DNA kind of getting around, more bacteria, more contact between different types of bacteria, right? So more chances of resistance happening. And also if we're using antibiotics, we're selecting only for those resistant bacteria, right? And then, replicates every 20 minutes. So we're rapidly increasing numbers of bacteria, especially after we use our antimicrobials. And we're just going to be left with a population of antimicrobial resistant bacteria.
And I just want to hit on that point again, Ben, around when we use it, we're selecting for resistance. What do you mean by that specifically? What is that? Talk to me about that process.
That's a great question and a great discussion point. When I talk about selecting for antimicrobial resistant bacteria, if we're treating a cow with antibiotics, right? There's a lot of bacteria in the gut of a cow, let's say. And sometimes you'll be, using systemic antimicrobials, which will affect the gut of the cow. That antibiotic is going to kill pretty much everything that it can, right? Any bacteria that are susceptible to that antibiotic, whereas the majority of the bacteria that are going to be left in that animal or wherever sites of treatment that you're doing, the udder, just a superficial wound or whatever, a lot of the bacteria that are going to be left are the ones that aren't killed. And the ones that aren't killed are often resistant to that antimicrobial or that antibiotic that you used.
Yeah. And so what we're left with is the strongest, right? It's the fitness.
Yeah. We're left with the strongest, the scariest, some dangerous things. That's why we talk so much about, prudent use of antimicrobials and antimicrobial stewardship, because the reason that antimicrobial resistance is such a global problem is because of antibiotic usage.
Ellen, maybe you can help us. I know from some of your research, you're probably well positioned to answer this. If we take what Ben's just talked about in terms of the development of resistance and the potential for that to spread quite rapidly and the selection pressure that we talk about when we use antibiotics, help us bring that home to the dairy industry where we see some of the conditions where we use antibiotics most frequently. So something like mastitis treatment, for example, is this where we are most concerned about resistance, or are we not really that concerned about resistance in our ability to treat dairy cattle infections? Is this more of a human health concern, or is it both?
I would say it's definitely both a human health and veterinary health concern. So mastitis is definitely an area where we use the most antibiotics to treat or either prevent cases from happening, as we see in the dry period with regular therapy. So that is an area where we could reduce the most antibiotics that we're using. But when we talk about areas where we see the most resistance, We've had studies where 10 to 15% of E. coli samples that we took were like multi-drug resistant. So it's definitely common. But I believe it's more so in calf health, where resistance can really take off really quickly if not treated properly or if bad managed, feeding waste milk to calves, etc. So resistance might be more prevalent on different parts of the farms, depending on the management that happens and the antibiotic, how the antibiotics are used in different areas. But if we look at a way, I think an easy way in to start reducing our antibiotic use and to show as an industry that we really care about this topic, I think is our mastitis treatments. We do have proper protocols in order to reduce use. And I think about those Trico products, we do have proper protocols in use to reduce our antibiotic use there domestically. So I think that's a really good starting point. And then when we have that under control, there's different areas on the farm, I think, where we can zoom in even more. And there's different groups in Canada working on that as well.
Great. So yeah, so some clear, you know, focus points or opportunities for improvement that we can maybe grasp onto and then work our way from there. That sounds, you know, pretty pragmatic to me. So let's talk a little bit about the research that you've been involved in here. Maybe Ben, we can start with you. Walk me through a little bit of some of the specific research questions you've been exploring as part of your PhD work.
The introductory chapter of my PhD is really going to be focusing on getting a baseline kind of prevalence estimate of the amount of antimicrobial resistance, specifically in Streptococcus and Enterococcus mastitis pathogens. And we have isolates from across Canada from that national cohort of dairy farm study that was done about 10 years ago or so. So that's going to be the first chapter, just kind of get a baseline, see where we're at in the dairy industry, specifically for those pathogens. Hasn't really been done yet, at least not on this scale. And then also look at the genomic kind of markers of antimicrobial resistance for those pathogens. So AMR can kind of develop in any number of ways. There's a lot of different genetic mechanisms for antibiotic resistance. And so finding out kind of what those mechanisms are for those bacteria. Are they, you know, kind of dairy specific? Are they kind of shared with other livestock? Are we seeing similar genetic mechanisms of AMR that we find often in human health from human bacterial isolates? Some things like that. And that kind of brings me naturally into what's going to be a bigger focus for my PhD, is where I'm really interested in the transmission of AMR, specifically antimicrobial resistance genes, between veterinary sources and human infections, right? So there's been a big debate for a long time. What is the risk for humans from antimicrobial resistance from animals in general? And livestock specifically, a lot of people have been worried about, right? Because that's one of the big trendy things to talk about is antimicrobial usage in veterinary medicine. There's been a long debate about, yeah, there's a huge risk, or no, there's not much risk. Generally, the consensus is there is some kind of risk, but the magnitude or the strength of that risk, and for the different pathogens, right? We don't really know yet. And that's kind of something I want to focus on for my PhD.
Very cool. Well, it sounds like you're going to answer, or help to answer anyway, a couple of key questions that we have and that are going to probably impact or influence not just decisions at the farm level or even, you know, across the veterinary profession, but may influence, you know, we know AMR is the subject of much regulation, not just in Canada, but in many countries. And no doubt lawmakers, given the, you know, the impact this could have on both animal and human populations, are looking at this closely. I have no insight into what, you know, may come, but certainly having those kinds of answers are going to go a long way in probably changing or informing the discussion anyway. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and that's kind of what we hope to do with our research, right? I always make some kind of a positive impact. I'm not a policy expert either. I'll leave that to some other folks. Just hopefully provide, you know, some of the risk estimates for you know, lawmakers to actually, you know, enforce it on a national and federal level.
So before we dig in a little bit more into how you're approaching some of those things, Ellen, same question for you. What are some of the research questions that you've been pursuing? What can you tell us about sort of the approaches and the research questions that you've been exploring?
Yeah, so starting with my PhD 5 years ago, I just became really interested in, first of all, looking what is out there in the research. What are protocols that are being used and what's the evidence behind it? So those were sort of my first questions, developing an evidence-based protocol to treat non-severe mastitis cases, seeing how we can make that selection process and therefore reduce antibiotic use. But not only looking at what type of protocols would we recommend, but also what the effects of those protocols. So that was sort of stage two, looking at different clinical trials that were published and seeing what those results really meant for the Canadian dairy industry. And lastly, what I did is a survey among 150 Canadian dairy farmers, again, mapping what treatment practices they are using and what factors go into play in their decision-making. That was sort of my final project. And I'm currently sort of, as a follow-up on that, doing interviews with farmers to really dive in, because it is a bit of a complex decision-making situation. That's sort of been the progression throughout my PhD with the different research questions.
Very cool. So a broad set of questions there, but also some very applicable on-farm questions and presumably answers as well, which is great. Ben, walk us through some of the key methods, some of the key steps that maybe you're taking or have taken to pursue some of those questions you talked to us about.
Yeah. So before I mentioned that I'm very interested in genomics, particularly bacterial genomics. So the main kind of method that I'm looking at is sequencing the DNA of as many kind of bacterial isolates that I can find from dairy sources, from beef sources, and then also combining them with swine, with any other kind of livestock, chicken isolates, from human isolates that I can get my hands on, to the point where I'm getting over 1,000 gigabytes of data of bacterial genomes, enough to kind of explode my computer more than a few times. So luckily for me that at the University of Calgary, we have some pretty fancy high performance computers that I can do my data analysis on, right? So with that genomic data, basically what we're going to do is compare the genomes of the different bacteria from the different sources. So from human sources, from dairy sources, from beef, wherever we can get our hands on, and do what we call like a phylodynamic and spatial modeling, which is basically comparing the genetics of the different bacteria and where they are, where you isolated them, so that we can kind of start to understand how they're spreading. If we find a bacteria from, say, a mastitis case that's extremely highly related to, let's say, a bloodstream infection from a human, which we will have access to pretty much all of the bloodstream infections from humans for the past 50 years in Alberta or something like that, then we can, you know, kind of estimate that, yeah, there is likely some sort of transmission, right? So if bacterial genomes are highly related, that means those strains of those bacteria are related. Likely there was some sort of transmission either from human to the animal or the animal to the human. A little bit difficult and tricky to understand the directionality of that. But that's something we're going to work on. Absolutely.
Very cool. And very technical. I always love some of those, approaches that I have no clue how they work. But I'm glad that there's folks like you that do know how they work, but what can you tell us about the results? Do you have anything you can share at this stage around the types of things you're seeing emerge?
Yeah. So, lately I've been looking at a, particularly dangerous form of antimicrobial resistance, starting with kind of a doomsday scenario, I guess. Something that we call vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. Vancomycin is an antibiotic that's kind of one of those last resort antibiotics, the ones that we use when no other antibiotic works. So I've been studying kind of the relationship of those bacteria in livestock and humans. And what we can see is, if antimicrobial resistance, at least in that pathogen, increases in livestock, the associated population, so the farmers or anybody that works with those animals, the prevalence of that in humans also increases. So it's like the antimicrobial resistances might be linked between farmers and their livestock. This is still a very preliminary result, so that's why I also say, I always say they might be linked, because we don't have the full data set yet. I'm still early in my PhD, but it's something that we expected to find just based on the direct contact and the fact that Enterococcus and many other bacteria like Staph aureus, a lot of farmers will know of, they can colonize or infect both their livestock and themselves, right? Quite often, we're colonized by Enterococcus and Staph aureus all over our body, which is why we, you know, thought we would see this kind of link. So basically, we have a lot more work to do, and then we can kind of get an actual number on, or an estimate of the actual risk farmers are at.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, again, very interesting. As you said, maybe we expect some of these things, but to be able to put numbers to it and start to have more of an informed conversation and presumably put numbers to a variety of other pathways for resistance development, or just seeing, do we see an increase in animal use and therefore downstream in human infection as well? Those will be very interesting results to come out. Ellen, let's switch to gears to your work. Talk to us a little bit about some of the methods, maybe of, I know you've got probably a bigger set of results maybe to share with us. Can you break down a couple of the key pieces of work that you've done, maybe some of the results that you have to share from that work?
So as I said earlier, that I started sort of off making an evidence-based protocol for the treatment of those non-severe cases. And what that protocol sort of entailed is using diagnostic tools to select cases for antibiotic treatment, but to also exclude cases for antibiotic treatment. And this is something that we've talked about on many presentations, and we've tried to convey at different conferences. But I feel like it's a key concept that would be very useful to farmers to get a better understanding of mastitis. So basically, what we try to recommend using that protocol is every time you see a non-severe case, you can also do this for severe cases, but you want to typically want to treat them right away. For those non-severe cases, taking a milk sample, waiting 24 hours, and then making your treatment decisions based on the results of that diagnostic test is a perfectly safe way to approach your treatment decisions. And then we recommend if that milk sample test result indicates a gram-positive, like a staphylococci, a streptococci, to give antibiotics. If it's negative, or if it indicates E. coli, that you can withhold with any antibiotic treatment. And then sort of that second half that I talked about earlier, where I try to estimate any effects of this treatment approach, I looked at 13 different clinical trials across North America, Europe, New Zealand, Australia, and they all used a very similar protocol like the one I just described, and they did not find any evidence of any negative consequences. So using that 24-hour wait period and using that diagnostic test to make that informed decision-making with that treating or no treating, no effects on bacteriological cure, no effects on clinical cure, no effects on occurrence of mastitis, on milk yield. So for me, that was really a key result from that first part of my PhD, and really, I think, a very important result to share with veterinarians and dairy farmers, that it is possible to reduce mastitis-related use, antibiotic use, in a fairly easy way. I say it's easy sort of in quotation marks because it does require you to send those diagnostic tests to your veterinarian or do that on your farm, right? So it's a little bit of an investment, but having that informed decision-making can really help. That was sort of part one and two of my PhD, sort of the methods that I did. And especially with that evidence-based protocol, we talked to a lot of mastitis experts in Canada and North America in general, to make sure that it fits a wide variety of farms. Yeah, and then for the second part, I did a survey among farmers in Canada, together with the Canadian Dairy Network for Antimicrobial Stewardship and Resistance. So we used their dairy farms to see what type of cases are farmers treating, what antibiotics are they treating with, what kind of decisions are they making, right? It's one thing knowing what type of protocol we want farmers to use, but it's another one of understanding what's going on a farm and what factors go into the decision making of the farmer when they are presented with a clinical mastitis case. So that was sort of the second part of that research. And yeah, I can go into the results of that part as well. So we found that about 60-65% of farmers in Canada actually use a selective treatment protocol, not always making selection based on the diagnostic test, the milk samples that I just talked about, but do making it a selection based on severity, bronchomastitis case history, cell count indicators. That was really positive to know, right? It's something definitely on the farmers' minds, and a large part is already being very mindful about the treatment decisions, although there's still a lot of improvements to make.
Very cool. I think the evidence-based protocol idea, the process for developing that, and where you've got to now, sounds so strong in terms of providing something that feels, at least in principle, very pragmatic, and also clearly from the evidence, from the science that's been done on it, gives us a lot of confidence in our ability to prudently use antibiotics, but also ensure that we're, doing what we're after in the first place when we treat or think about treating is, what's the best interest, not just from a food safety or milk quality perspective, but also the health and welfare of the animal. So it sounds like we can really nicely sort of dovetail both of those things together at the end of the day. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, exactly. Because I spoke to a lot of farmers and their biggest concern is, not treating cases that need to be treated. Right? Like you see an animal in pain and you see inflammation, and that's something that you want to help with. So giving evidence that it's okay to wait and that it will not affect the cow's welfare, I think is really strong. One remark though is that we do recommend giving non-steroidal anti-inflammatories if you decide to not treat, for instance, for chronic staph cases, right? They typically do not respond to antibiotics anyways, because they're so embedded in the udder. But giving anti-inflammatories to those cows can really do help their welfare. And that's something I feel that still needs to gain a little bit of more traction among producers and veterinarians to give that pain medication.
Yeah, very interesting and an important point. You're right, especially when we talk about the welfare elements of this. And what you've said in general sort of resonates with me as someone that's been involved in some research over the years on this topic, particularly trying to understand what farmers and veterinarians think about, not just the topic of resistance, but how and what factors influence their decision to prescribe, for example, and things. And just to align with what you had said, many veterinarians and farmers talk about their concern over the stewardship or prudent use sort of conversation, and saying a reduction in use or our ability to use antibiotics, is a potential concern in terms of our ability to manage welfare and the health, which is of course a top priority, not just to produce safe quality food, but because it's the right thing to do, as owners and as stewards of these animals. And so again, finding ways to not just say, we must, unilaterally in the industry stop using antibiotics, but finding ways to do that, in a way that still ensures that we can maintain the health and welfare of animals seems to be so critical. And again, why I think some of the work both of you are doing is so important to get a more informed understanding and therefore enable our strategic use of antibiotics, if that's a different term to use, thinking about this. As we round out our conversation here, I want to ask both of you one key question. What do you think is the bottom line? What's the take-home message from either where you sit today as a researcher, maybe based on the results and the work that you've been you've done thus far and continue to pursue, or simply just a piece of advice or message you'd share with our listeners who could be spanning from farmers to veterinarians to members of industry and government to the public?
It's important to drive home the idea that that transmission of bacteria and a microbial resistance can happen between the farmers and their animals, right? It's something that a lot of people don't necessarily think about as a population at risk. They either think, oh, the AMR is developing in the animals, and that's why we're worried about it, because the human doctors tell us to worry about it. This transmission can happen, and a good kind of evidence of that, of bacteria transmitting between humans and their animals, bacteria or antimicrobial resistance doesn't care about borders, doesn't care about individual species of animal or human, things like that, right? So just thinking about those kinds of risks and motivate prudent use of antibiotics, I think, is an important take-home message for any listeners.
Yeah, for me, I think using a selective clinical mastitis treatment protocol is a nice way of reducing antibiotic use on farm. I'm showing as a dairy industry that we're responsible stewards. And that there's no negative consequences in using that selective protocol that's based on those rapid diagnostic testing. It's very safe to wait 24 hours for those non-severe cases to make your treatment decisions based on those test results. I think it's just a lot more awareness is necessary and a lot more conversations between farmers and veterinarians, farmers and other farmers.
Well, that's great. And I think, you know, with that, this conversation and this output hopefully will be, one of many, opportunities to motivate and inform and influence some conversation, some awareness out there. So thank you both for taking the time to walk us through what you've been doing, the important work that you're conducting. And thanks again. Best of luck with the rest of your work.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Dairy Farmers of Canada's research podcast series. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. For more information, please visit dairyfarmersofcanada.ca/en/dairy-research. This podcast was narrated by myself, Stephen Roach, edited and produced by Carly Wright. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The project is part of Dairy Research Cluster 3, a national research funding program made possible by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada's Agri-Science Clusters program, the Dairy Farmers of Canada, Lactinet, and Novalay.